what I'm going to try to do, I guess this week, the next, till Pesach, is the next 2-3 weeks, is I want to approach Pesach by speaking about the different mitzvahs which revolve around Pesach, and then we'll try to discuss them both in a practical way and in a conceptual, symbolic way, in both ways. So it'll give us some practical advice about how to approach Pesach and then some meaning behind all the different mitzvahs and customs and rules of Pesach itself. I mean, Pesach, we mentioned, is the first Yom Tov of the year according to the Torah's calendar. I keep stressing that. Which means that symbolically, Pesach is looked at as sort of step one. You look at the yearly cycle as a process. And Purim, we said, ended that process. Pesach starts that process. It's the holiday of freedom. It's the holiday where we're supposed to have a fresh start, a fresh relationship with God. And it's the time where we were chosen as a people. When God came into Egypt and freed the Jews, that was the point where God said, "You're now my chosen people. I'm giving you a mission. I'm creating a special relationship between myself and you." And that's how we should view Pesach, is that first step into the relationship. I mean, in a certain way, the three regalim, the pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, could be viewed in terms of, it's called the cycle of a marriage. And Pesach being, let's call it maybe the engagement, and Shavuos being the actual marriage, and then Sukkot, I don't know, you call it the honeymoon, it's the long-term relationship between the two. And Pesach is where there's this excitement, there's this love, there's this God came in and saved us and did all sorts of miraculous things for us. In Shavuos, we actually make a commitment to God. Through receiving the Torah, we're committing to one another, which is actually the marriage itself. The engagement itself is not really a commitment. The commitment's really through marriage. And then Sukkot, when we move into God's house, as it was, we walk out into the Sukkah, that's more symbolic of a long-term relationship with living each other in a lifetime. So I guess we can discuss each one as we approach the holiday. Pesach is that first step. It's that first rendezvous of God and the Jewish people. And Pesach takes a lot of preparation. Of all the Yomim Tovim, Pesach is the one with the most laborious physical preparations. And we spend so much time and energy really on one mitzvah before Pesach. There's one mitzvah in the Torah which some people work on for two months beforehand, which is clearing our lives and houses of chametz. The Torah tells us that on Pesach itself, chametz is something that's prohibited not only to eat, but to benefit from, and even to own on Pesach. That's why chametz is so severe in terms of preparing for Pesach. So we have to make sure that we don't eat it on Pesach, we don't benefit from it on Pesach, we don't even own any on Pesach. That means that people are searching their house for the smallest little breadcrumb because maybe it'll end up in their, you know, in their kitchen. We're trying to make sure all of our cabinets are under control. The chametz in our homes is at least... we're aware of it all, have it in one place to sell if we sell it, or we destroy it all, we get rid of it all, but it's a big process, besides just getting the kitchen ready in terms of getting your dishes ready, koshering the oven, making sure everything has all of its chametz flavor out of it, just so we're ready for Pesach. I mean, that's in terms of the halacha, that's the severity of its prohibition. The mitzvah to eat matzah is actually a separate discussion we can have, but before the mitzvah of eating matzah, we have the prohibition on chametz. Just to define chametz, it means there's five grains that halacha discusses as the five grains of Israel, which are wheat, barley, oats, spelt, and rye. Those are the five grains. Any of those grains comes in contact with the liquid and is left for a certain period of time, that becomes chametz. Traditionally, so matzah, we say that the cutoff line is 18 minutes traditionally. So once water hits matzah, you have 18 minutes to get it cooked. If it doesn't get cooked at that point, it is chametz and has to be thrown out, basically. So if you ever go into a matzah bakery, which I personally have never had a chance to do, but I hear about it, they have even online now, they have videos of matzah bakeries. I mean, every 18 minutes, the alarm sounds, everything gets cleaned out again, they start fresh. So anything that didn't make it into the oven after 18 minutes, or make it out of the oven after 18 minutes, is trashed, and they start fresh once again, you know, a new batch.
Well, is that cleaned. Timing is so serious? Is the alarm really going off like at 17 minutes and 30 seconds? I mean, if it has to be out of the oven in 18 seconds, I mean in 18 minutes. I'm just really serious.
That's a good question. I mean, typically it's all done, within 14 or 15 minutes, just to be careful.
Okay.
But then, that buzzer is telling you this is it, deadline, it's over.
I'm not sure.
They may have warnings along the way.
Okay.
They may have along the way. But ultimately, 18 minutes traditionally is our deadline.
Okay.
So that applies, so typically we make wheat matzahs, but that applies to any of the five grains. So you can find nowadays spelt matzah, and you can find oat matzah, I think. So people who have different issues, health-wise, allergies, you can get other types of matzah. So anything which could be used for matzah, that means, equal, let me say it that way, anything which can potentially be chametz is a valid grain for matzah. So for instance, rice technically cannot be chametz. Chametz is only one of the five grains. So you cannot make a rice matzah either, because that would not be valid for your mitzvah, rice matzah. Ashkenazim have the custom to avoid rice and other types of kokitnios, and beans and corn, peas, etc. on Pesach, but that's a later custom. In terms of matzah versus chametz, rice technically can neither be matzah nor chametz. But the five grains, wheat, oats, barley, spelt, and rye, could become chametz, and therefore if you cook them fast enough, could become matzah. That's just the basic understanding of what chametz is. So if you look through your home, so many things are chametz, because you know, so many things we do use wheat, grain, barley, oats, and it's in a lot of products. So that's, we're searching for that in our homes and making sure it's broke. We have it all gone prior to Pesach. Just in terms of practical preparations, the ways we get rid of chametz, there's really three methods. Two of them are obligatory in halacha, and one of them is that people also do just to make their lives easier. We have to, before Pesach, search and destroy the chametz that we find. So that's the night before Pesach, there's a mitzvah of bedikas chametz, where we search and destroy. We have to also nullify chametz, which means there's a declaration to make, which you declare any chametz that I have not found, or even that which I have found, I declare ownerless and null and void, and you've now annulled that chametz. No longer has any meaning to you. That's a declaration we make as well. It should be sincere, you should understand the words. There's a sincere declaration that we're trying to get the chametz out of our lives. And the other thing people do, which is not obligatory, but many do it so they don't have to go through as much of a hassle, is by selling the chametz. Really, the rabbi of every shul will do a sale of chametz, they'll sell it to a non-Jew for the course of Pesach. And therefore, if you have a lot of chametz in your cabinet that you don't want to destroy, it could be worth a lot of money, it's too much of a hassle for you. So then, this doesn't get you out of the obligation to search the rest of your house, but does allow you to keep food in your home on Pesach, which may be chametz, because during that point, it'll be owned by a non-Jew, not by yourself. So it's especially relevant if someone has a lot of expensive liquor or something like that. That's definitely a place where people will sell their chametz and don't have to get rid of their $50 bottle of whatever it is. But overall, so people who don't want to go through the hassle of emptying out their freezers and pantries and everything else are able to sell the chametz to a non-Jew through the rabbi of the shul. And that will, so technically then you don't own it over Pesach, and you've also avoided this prohibition of owning chametz. But that doesn't get you out of the obligation, again, of searching and destroying whatever you do find the rest of your house. And you should be aware of all the chametz in your home, whether it's in the cabinet to be sold, or whether you've searched for it and destroyed it from under your couch, or in your kitchen, or wherever it is. But that is part of the obligation of chametz, search and destroy. And then nullifying, we have a declaration, it's found in every sitter, to nullify the chametz. And that's all done by on Erev Pesach, we nullify and search and destroy. So when we clean our home so well that you don't find any hidden chametz, you get all the crumbs, you want to avoid it all from entering into your kitchen. I'll wait till we finish
this out. Is it literally a Gentile, or is it figurative?
Like, literally. The rabbi actually will find a Gentile, and there's a contract. He actually will accept money from the Gentile, and Gentile has total rights on the chametz over Pesach. So usually they will not come to claim their chametz. Afterwards, the rabbi will go back and the sale will become void. But there are rabbis, I think in Baltimore, I've heard that the rabbi actually has told the non-Jew, please go to the homes and partake. Because people have to realize the sale is a real sale. So if he comes and knocks on your door and says, I'd like to have my bottle of Jack Daniels, please, it's his. You know, you have to give it to him. You know, it's not an option. So it's a real sale. It's really done with a contract and everything.
But if when the contract is over... So the sale is through late nights?
Right.
Is that how the contract reads?
The contract, I don't know exactly the wording.
Okay, but
basically,
whatever.
The non-Jew will have an option at the end of the 8 nights to pay a large sum of money and officially keep all the chametz in the town. Or he can say, I don't want it anymore, and then at that point, it goes back to the ownership of the Jew. So technically, the non-Jew wanted to take the option on after 8 nights and say, I'd really like to own all the chametz in the city. He really could, but you have to probably put forth, I don't know the sum of money they put into the contract, but it'd be a large sum of money. But it's worded in the right legal wording,
so it
works, etc. That's why you should always do it through the rabbi and not yourself, because you have to make sure you have the contract halachically correct.
You said before, keeping chametz, if you wanted to keep your chametz in the freezer, how could you do that?
Probably meant the freezer in the basement, not the freezer.
Well, if you're using that freezer, you really shouldn't keep it in there. If it's freezer you're using, okay. Right?
Yeah.
Right. It should be sealed off. This location is not mine. This is sealed off. I'm not gonna deal with it on Pesach. Yeah, right. Yeah, if you have two fridges. Yeah, the stores. Yeah, they certainly they cover it up. Right. Yeah, for stores to have to actually destroy their chametz would be a tremendous financial loss. So nowadays, most of the stores also sell their chametz as well at that point. And it applies really to any Jewish-owned store. So like, for instance, in Magruder's, we have in Kent Mill, is Jewish-owned. And you have to be sure that even if the owner is not an observant Jew, you have to be sure the chametz is sold or else it's forbidden to eat afterwards. So, which is, it comes up with not so many stores these days. There are a few out there, which there's a list of the Jewish-owned stores to be aware of. Magruder's now does sell their chametz. The Revival Rabbanim of Washington arranged that, so now they do sell their chametz. So that's the technical prohibition on chametz. And again, which leads us to search and destroy and to nullify. So that's in terms of the practical aspect of it. And the prohibition is so severe that even one crumb is prohibited. Typically, when it comes to non-kosher food, there's a concept that if you have a 1 to 60 ratio, it becomes null and void. When it comes to chametz, one little crumb in a huge vat of food would also prohibit the entire amount of food. That's how severe this prohibition is. So I want to discuss now more symbolically, what's so bad about chametz? We understand, so those are the laws of chametz. And the laws of chametz are very severe. There's a lot that we put into destroying the chametz, getting rid of the chametz. But symbolically, how do we understand chametz? Why is chametz so severe? Symbolically, what's the meaning behind this mitzvah? And again, every mitzvah has several meanings. There's a lot, I can't tell you this is the meaning of the mitzvah, but there's a lot of layers of understanding of a mitzvah, and we try to always give some meaning to what we're doing. So what's so terrible about chametz? Why is it such a severe thing? Even that one little crumb, that's it. I can't eat my food anymore. So there's a Gemara that says in the Gemara that, you know, deep down, every Jew really wants to do the will of God. We have our soul, and the soul yearns out to connect with God. So the Gemara says, you know, Ritzoneinu, our will is La'asos Ritzon Avinu Shebashamayim. Our will is to do the will of our Father in heaven. So the Gemara asks, okay, if that's the case, what stops us? How come so many of us don't always do what's right? How come so many of us aren't acting as we should, when really deep down that's all we want? Deep down that's all our soul yearns for. So how come we don't do what we're supposed to do? So the Gemara gives two reasons why we don't do what we're supposed to do. The Gemara says, number one, something called Shibu Malchios, which literally means the fact that we're subject to other nations, which in my mind means there's external challenges which come our way. The fact that there is anti-Semitism, the fact that there's external pressure on us, there's challenges in terms of there's financial challenges, there's societal challenges, cultural challenges. These are all things which I would put under the umbrella of Shibu Malchios. It's the fact that we're subject to other nations. If there weren't other people pressuring us, so then that would free us up to really do God's will in a much more effective manner. So that's one reason the Gemara gives. The other reason the Gemara gives, it says there's Shibu Malchios, there's something called Seor Shebi'isa. There's the yeast in the bread, the yeast in the dough. The yeast in the dough also prevents us from doing what's right. So what is it? Obviously it's a metaphor, the yeast in the dough. It's not because there's yeast that we don't do what's right. There's a metaphor called the yeast in the dough, which refers to chametz. Chametz is that leavening, what makes the dough rise. And so the Gemara says the two things which keep us from doing God's will are the Shibu Malchios, the fact that we're subject to the other nations, and the yeast in the dough. So what's the yeast in the dough? So the yeast in the dough represents to us there's internal resistance also to performing God's will. And there's not only external resistance, external challenges, which is the Shibu Malchios aspect, the fact that we're subject to other nations. There's also that internal aspect, which we refer to as yeast in the dough, as chametz. And I want to explain that metaphor, but how come chametz is the metaphor we put to those internal challenges and internal resistance we have to doing what's right in life? So, and also, the external challenges, they're really out of our control. I mean, we can't control the fact that we're subject to other nations. That's something we can't change. That's just the reality of living in this world. The internal challenges are something that we can deal with. The fact that we have internal resistance within ourselves to doing what's right, that's something that we can approach. So we can't say that there's a holiday we have to get rid of all the external challenges. That can't be done. We can't get rid of external challenges. But symbolically, when we rid ourselves of chametz, it means that deep down we should be ridding ourselves of these internal challenges to doing what's right. And so I want to explain that metaphor. Why is the metaphor the yeast in the dough? Why is that the way it's described? So, you know, deep down, you know, what?
The yeast is very good. It's
very good. So like I said, deep down there is this desire always to do what's right. We want to be good, honesty, spirituality, peace, connection to God. All these things are something which deep down people want to do. But we're not always free to act on what we want. I mean, like, Pesach is a holiday of freedom. It's called Zman Chiruseinu. And obviously, when we rid ourselves of chametz, it should also contribute to the idea of freedom, of being free. So really, internally, we have our desires, but our body resists for some reason. We know deep down that we always want to be honest, but for some reason, there are times where we're dishonest. We feel bad about it. We feel guilty about it, but our body just drives us to that. Really, we want to reach out and be friendly to others. Sometimes we just don't do it, and we can't figure out why. So we know that's the right thing to do, but our body resists. We don't feel free to do what our ideals are. We want to do. We feel we are somewhat challenged or inhibited, enslaved in some way. So there's a part in the person, which the Torah tells us, that Hashem created within us to create that challenge. It's called Yetzer Hara, our inclination towards evil. And that's something within every person, which is put there to create that challenge on purpose. You know, God didn't, it's not just we happen to have resistance. God gave us our neshama, He gave us our soul, which is there to reach out to God, and God gave us the Yetzer Hara, a part of us which resists, and gives us challenges and struggles. And the challenges are necessary because if everything came easy, then there's no room for choice, for reward, for punishment. If we just automatically did what was right, we'd be robots, we wouldn't be individuals, we wouldn't be able to grow and develop our own way. So God has to give us challenges. So I'm giving you a challenge. It's called Yetzer Hara, something inside of you. It's something which challenges you. It traps you in a certain sense. There's always that resistance. It's internal resistance to what's right. That's what it is. But when you overcome that resistance, that's when you grow, that's when you change, that's where you're making those choices to free yourself. You're freeing yourself from those grasps. So the internal bondage really, it traps us in a lot of ways. So this is the Yetzer Hara. This metaphor of the yeast and the dough is the metaphor for the Yetzer Hara, the inclination in ourselves towards evil, that resistance we have towards doing what's right. Matzah is the contrast to that. There's chametz and there's matzah. Chametz is what represents the Yetzer Hara, and matzah represents the other side of it, that which is good, that which is innocent, straightforward, simple. And let's understand, matzah is something, it is just something very simple, straightforward. It's water, it's flour, it is what it is. You bake it, it's done. There's nothing more to it than what it is. It's totally substance. If you think on a conceptual level, the leavening in something, when something becomes chametz and it rises, what changes? I mean, the ingredients are the same. It's the same thing, but yet it's sort of blown up. You know, air is added. You're adding sort of nothingness to it. It might look more attractive. I mean, definitely we would probably all agree that bread might be tastier than matzah, might be easier on the stomach than matzah, might be more appetizing in a sandwich than matzah. So the leavening, the fact that it rises, which doesn't require yeast per se, just if you leave it there, it still would rise, that makes it more attractive and tasty and fluffy. But it's lacking substance. Matzah is all substance. That's what it is. It's just, it is what it is. It's flour and water. Nothing is making it. There's no sugar in the matzah. There's no salt in the matzah. It's just flour and water. That's it. But you can buy egg matzahs and all these other things. But in terms of the mitzvah of matzah on Pesach night, you're not allowed to use that. You can only use matzah, which is flour and water, finished. That's the matzah you're allowed to use Pesach night for your mitzvah. So that represents the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is something which is really, it's the same idea as chametz. It's that it creates illusions of success. I think it creates illusions of accomplishment. It creates illusions of pleasure. It creates goals which are really illusions to us. They seem real, but really they're a mirage. And like, for instance, matzah is something which is substantial. It's not an illusion. There's nothing that which is a mirage but matzah. It is what it is. When you look at bread, there's air inside. It's something which is puffed up and fluffy, but really the ingredients are the same thing as matzah. It's just now puffed up and it looks different. So the Yetzer Hara might tell me, you know, be a little dishonest, but it's worth it. The wealth you get out of this little cheating, steal a little bit here, it's worth it. I'm giving you a new goal, and that goal is you're going to become a wealthy man. It might create some dishonesty, but just do it. It's worthwhile. Having that goal of being wealthy, that's true success. That's what the Yetzer Hara tells me. Money is everything. That's all that matters in life is money, and that's a goal the Yetzer Hara might put in our minds, and it seems attractive. We think about it. It might seem pleasurable when we think through it, but really it's not substantial. Really, it's an illusion. That's not true accomplishment in life. The Yetzer Hara might tell me, speak lashon hara, speak badly about somebody else. You're gonna feel good about it. It's gonna boost your ego. You know, it'll make you feel good. That person's terrible anyways. Who cares about them? And I'm gonna get a false sense of accomplishment through that. I didn't become a better person by speaking badly about somebody else. It didn't make me better. But when I denigrate that person, I feel like I'm a better person. It makes me boost myself, boost my own ego. But that's the Yetzer Hara fluffing it up. It really, it's not a substantial gain in a person's life. The pleasure is not a substantial pleasure. It's an illusion. You're not really a better person because of it. But when you say bad things about another person, you feel better. You feel good about yourself. But it's all a mirage. You know, the Yetzer Hara comes and tells me, eat that next piece of cake. You're going to really enjoy the piece of cake. And, you know, when I look at the cake, it looks really, really delicious. It looks like, oh, this is going to be real pleasurable eating this cake. Afterwards, you know, my stomach hurts, I feel disgusting, I feel fat, my doctor says my cholesterol is high, whatever it is. But so it was an illusion. You thought it was a good idea. Yetzer Hara tells you to eat that cake, it's the right thing to do, it's going to be real pleasurable. But yet, that was a mirage. It was all just, you know, fluffed up. So then it wasn't Yetzer Hara.
It's an antidepressant
that
tastes good.
So then it wasn't Yetzer Hara leading you to it. It was a good idea. I'm saying, not everything's Yetzer Hara telling you to eat cake. Sometimes cake can be coming from a good source as well. The Torah tells you enjoy Shabbos, you know, things like that. You know, you can always enjoy a piece of cake. I'm just saying, the second piece of cake sometimes. You know, that's the one. The second piece of cake.
So in other words, the yeast is almost like your Yetzer Hara. You're getting rid of the yeast from the flour.
Right.
And you need to get the yeast
out of
yourself.
Exactly.
Yourself
right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yes.
I've heard the yeast.
Pride. Pride. Yes. Actually, I want to get to that a little later, maybe. Right. Pride. Yeah. Arrogance. Yeah. The question about why on Pesach, maybe we'll also address. It's a good question, too. Maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. So, all of these things are just imaginary goals, imaginary pleasures, which in the long-term perspective are not actually pleasures, not actually goals, not actually successes. But yet, at the time, we feel that they are pleasurable and they are accomplishment. Really, they're not. And that's really what the Yetzer Hara does to us. And that's this metaphor of yeast. Yeast puffs up the bread. It makes it look fluffier. It makes it look nicer. It makes it even taste better. But substantially, the bread hasn't really changed. And that's the idea of chametz versus matzah is something which is real, is substantial. I'll call matzah. It's true. I mean, there's nothing there in matzah which will deceive you. You see what it is. It is what it is. Bread has its air pockets and has its fluff, which isn't really, it's the flour and water, but it's just been bloated, basically. That's the idea of bread. So Pesach is this beginning of relationship with God. And so as we approach Pesach, when we search and destroy every piece of chametz we can find, so symbolically that also means we're supposed to be searching and destroying in ourselves the chametz. There's actually a prayer that's printed in a lot of the Sidurim at the time of when you burn the chametz. And the prayer says, just like we've merited to fulfill the mitzvah and destroy the chametz from our homes, we should also merit to destroy the chametz from our own, from ourselves, from our lives. And it means this idea, this Yetzer Hara, this all these illusions and these imaginary goals and imaginary accomplishments, we should also merit to pull out of ourselves and to overcome and to conquer. So there's that dual meaning to chametz. So the mitzvah is physically we go and destroy all the chametz, but conceptually, beyond that, and not at the expense of the physical mitzvah, but conceptually we have to always remember that destroying the chametz doesn't just mean externally, it also means internally. And that's part of this idea of chametz. So even one speck of chametz we try to avoid, that one little speck, is still, we want our lives to be real and substantial and true and straight. We don't want to have even that one speck of dishonesty or crookedness or fluffiness. We want everything to be real. We want to be able to do what's right. So in terms of the idea of freedom, when we have the Yetzer Hara giving us these imaginary goals and pushing us in directions we don't really want to go, and we follow it many times, we're not free. We're still not totally free. Because we're not free to do what we feel is right, what we want to do in life. You're only free once you can make the choice that you truly want to make. If you have choices, but your Yetzer Hara forces you in one direction. So a lot of times, our brain tells us that second piece of cake is not a good idea. And our stomach tells us it looks really good. Right? That happens all the time. So, in a sense, we really want to choose not to eat the cake. But a lot of times we just can't make that choice, and our bodies make us take that piece of cake and eat it. And I'm using cake as the analogy, but it applies in so many ways in life. You know, really, I don't want to speak badly about this other person, but I just have the urge. I have to do it. I know it's wrong. I don't want to do it, and I don't want to choose to do it that way, but I have to do it. So it's still bondage in a certain sense. I'm not free. When you actually are free, you're able to choose what you really want to choose. That's freedom. That's true freedom. So Pesach is the holiday of freedom. We free ourselves from this internal bondage, which is part of our lives, which we try to avoid. Pesach also, so now I'm going to move into what Stan was mentioning. Pesach also is the time, as we mentioned, which is the beginning of the relationship with God. It's that first step, we call it the engagement, it's that first rendezvous, however you want to describe it. It's that first relationship we have with God. Allowing God into our lives is predicated on the fact that we understand there is a master above us. Now, the world doesn't center around me, the world centers around God. God is the master. If the world centers around me, then basically I'm making myself God, and God's just another one of my my subjects. But the first step in relating to God is understanding that there's me and there's God. God's my master, and I'm the servant. And God doesn't work around me, I work around God. That's step one in relating to God. The chametz, in addition to representing Yitzhahara, represents arrogance. Like Stan was mentioning before, the fact that it's something which is bloated, it's full of itself, basically. Chametz, a little piece of bread. Matzah is something which is very simple, down to earth. You call it humble. Chametz represents something which is bloated and it's full of itself. It's arrogant. So, symbolically, when I'm first approaching my relationship with God, I have to understand that God's in charge. I'm second to God. Like second. I mean, I'm a lowly person vis-a-vis God. And if I approach that relationship with arrogance, and I think I'm the center of the world, so then there's no room for God in my life. If I understand that really God's the center, and I'm just one of God's subjects, so then now there's room for me to relate with God. But that's really step one in a relationship with God. So matzah represents that humble innocence, and chametz represents what we call gaiva, the arrogance, the hubris, that type of thing. It's bloated and puffed up and full of itself. The humility is such an important aspect in relating to God. You have to step one in that relationship, Pesach time, which is the first month in step one in terms of this process, has to be humility. I step into it totally humbled, that I'm humbled before God. God is all-powerful, and I'm nothing. So to remember that, we rid ourselves of chametz, which is the external chametz, but also the internal arrogance, and we bring matzah into our lives. Matzah is that bread which reminds us of the freedom, of the miracles of God. Matzah is something which is simple and straight and humble. That's how you be matzah. To address the question I think Phil was asking before, which was, if chametz is so terrible, how can we eat it all year long? We were in a beautiful bagel place here with great bagels, bialys, everything else. And we enjoy it, we're supposed to enjoy it, it's kosher, everything's fine about bread all year long until Pesach comes along. So what's that concept? So there is actually an interesting correlation of chametz and matzah and Pesach and Shavuos. On Pesach, we again go at length to rid ourselves of every speck of chametz that's out there. On Shavuos, there's actually an offering brought in the temple of chametz. There's an offering called the Shtei Halechem. It's two loaves of bread, which are an offering brought in the temple itself on Shavuos. So we've gone from running around for a month trying to find every crumb of chametz in our homes to actually bringing to God loaves of bread. And it strikes you, well, why is there that difference? And there's many explanations given. One explanation given is that on Pesach we became a nation and we committed to relating with God, but yet we weren't given our instructions. We weren't given the Torah yet. On Shavuos we were given the Torah. So when it comes to Pesach, if we have no instructions as to how do I control my urges, what's my mission, what's my method through which I'm able to relate to God, we're just told, be a people and relate to God. The Torah is not given yet in Pesach time. So then, you have no controls over Yitzhahara. You have no controls over your urges. You don't have any method. There's no instruction booklet. The Torah is our instruction booklet, which helps us control urges. The Torah teaches us how to keep things in line, keep it in control. So when it comes to Shavuos, the Torah is given. We're able to say, I understand I have a Yitzhahara within myself. I have urges. But those urges can be offered to God. I'm able to take those urges and channel them in the right direction, keep them under control. And therefore, in Shavuos, chametz is appropriate, because we are human beings, and we do have urges, we do have Yitzhahara, we do have that resistance, and the Torah is our training ground. The Torah teaches us how to channel that resistance in the right direction, how to deal with it, how to overcome it. When it comes to Pesach, before the Torah is given, we're just free from Egypt, so then we're a free people, but we don't have any instructions as to how to deal with Yitzhahara. We don't know how to deal with our challenges. So the idea on Pesach is to rid ourselves of those challenges totally. On Shavuos, we recognize that we are human, we do have challenges, and now we allow the Torah to teach us how to deal with them, how to keep them in control. So that's why the rest of the year, it's not that first step of the relationship. But the rest of the year, we recognize that God's given up, we are human beings, and we have challenges and resistance within ourselves doing what's right. And we recognize that God gave us an instruction booklet on how to deal with it. The word itself, Torah in modern Hebrew, if you look at, like, I think a driver's manual is called Torah Hanagah. It's a driver's manual. It's a manual. That's what Torah means, instructions or manual. That's what the word means. And the Torah is viewed as a manual of how to live life in control and do what's right. On Pesach, that Torah wasn't given yet, so therefore we have to just totally become, step aside from any challenges, try to be totally pure and avoid challenge. On Shavuos, we understand we can approach the world with our instructions and still do what's right, even within the challenges. So that's those two steps of Pesach and Shavuos. So those are two symbolisms of chametz, this idea of yetzer hara, the idea of arrogance, which are both appropriate to Pesach and help us understand why every single little crumb and morsel is a problem. Any questions on this? I'm going to move on to one other topic. If there are any questions on chametz. No. Yeah.
Under the five commandments, the negative commandments of chametz, that the chametz were not supposed to have mixtures. So I think that's where that little teeny bit comes from.
Right. Yeah, even the little mixture is a problem. Am I correct? Yeah. A little teeny bit. But even that one little crumb has to be avoided. I mean, there's a lot of stringency involved in just terms of people getting ready for Pesach, and people scrubbing on everything, scrubbing on the walls. I mean, but even though a lot of that's not necessary in terms of the halacha, but the custom amongst Jewish people has always been to just be so careful about Pesach. And part of it has to do with the symbolism, that we want to make sure that every little morsel of evil and of blootedness is removed from ourselves. So symbolically, we scrub everything.
Can you go back to that term, one of 60 versus 160th versus
1? Yeah. In a typical situation, let's say you're making a chicken soup, kosher chicken soup, and someone accidentally drops in a piece of ham. So as long as there's a 1-60 ratio between the ham and the chicken soup, it's still a kosher chicken soup. You should remove a piece of ham if you can find it, but the soup means kosher. If the proportion is less than that, the soup itself becomes non-kosher.
I don't know.
That's the typical halacha. But there are certain exceptions, like Pesach is one exception, where even that one morsel of chametz, one little crumb, into a bathtub full of food will make it all prohibited. Yeah.
So it's only if it gets in your food. I mean, I've heard that if it's a crumb on the floor that even a dog wouldn't eat.
Yes,
but like
in terms of ownership, that's not an issue. But in terms of getting your food, so people, the kitchen should be very careful with, because there could be crumbs around the kitchen that might fall into things as Pesach goes along.
Yeah, but like it's under the refrigerator.
Yeah, there's a crumb under the refrigerator. Yeah, if there were the crumb, right? That's not a problem. There's a crumb under the refrigerator. That's not necessary. That's not technically a lot of a problem. As long as you've cleaned up any pieces which are of significance. And they usually say that a Cheerio size is like that's the smallest significant type of food. If you've cleaned for that, in terms of your obligation of cleaning and destroying, that's sufficient. But in terms of like your kitchen and the possibility of things falling into food, you gotta be careful with crumbs in terms of that. Lots of people will scrub down, you know, their doorknobs and their phones, things like that. And you're surprised where chametz, or at least chametz grease, things like that, may exist in your homes as you clean for Pesach. Especially if you have little kids running around, that's for sure.
But I was going to ask you that about children, since you've said Cheerios, and as you probably have them in your house.
Yeah.
What happens if you thought you got them all, the next thing you know is the second day of Pesach, and you see your little two-year-old shoving these shit, wherever he hid the Cheerios, he found them. So what do you
say? So you have to immediately search and destroy.
But do our children,
I mean, the child technically isn't obligated, but being it's your child in your home, you have to make sure the chametz isn't there.
Yeah, I was just wondering.
Yeah, so I mean, you don't blame the child for it, but you still have an obligation to find every Cheerio he put around the house and search and destroy. I mean, the Gemara discusses cases, let's say a squirrel runs in your house carrying a loaf of bread or something. You know, what do you do at that point? I mean, even, I think it was last Pesach around Camp Mill, they were tossing around with the Gazette boxes of cereal. You remember that? I think it was last Pesach.
That's right.
Pesach, 2 years ago maybe, yeah. So Erev Pesach, I'm ready to burn my chametz. Suddenly the Gazette's tossed in my yard with a box of, like, I don't know, Trix or something, you know, of chametz cereal. You know, it came in just early enough that I was able to burn it at that point. But if that happens on day two of Pesach, you know, it's on your property, you have to do something with it. So the situations do happen. You know, I never get cereal in the newspaper besides on Erev Pesach. It's the only time it comes. Yeah.
So
you'd have to also destroy it at that point. If it's on Yom Tov itself, you can't burn it. You should just cover it up until after Yom Tov. But if it's Chol Moed or before Yom Tov, you should just immediately destroy it, basically. either that or you immediately have a non-Jewish neighbor come and take whatever it is. You have to address it some way. You can't just leave it on your property. Yeah.
But for the individual, the child finds something previously nullified and said it's like the dust of the earth.
Right.
So I don't think like the individual has, let's say, responsibility contamination.
But once you find it and you make a decision, I'm not going to worry about it, that already makes you responsible at that point. So if it is in your home and you decide I'm just going to leave it there, so now you've basically taken... Yeah, but you are, if he finds it, you haven't violated that prohibition. Unless you subsequently decide, I don't care anymore. And then
when he finds it, you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
The fact that he found it.
Right, that's not a problem. Right. If you've done your best, you've done your best. There's always something. You can't get every single crumb in the house. There's always, especially when you have little kids running around, there's going to be a Cheerio somewhere. That's for sure. You might find it at the bottom of your sock drawer, but it'll be somewhere. So, but if you have to do your best, we don't have a radar trying to find. There's a radar to track to figure out where the comet is. True detector, yeah, right. Yeah. You do your best. Just for in the coming weeks, I want to discuss more about the mitzvahs of Pesach in terms of eating matzah, the maror, the seder, etc. We'll get more into the specifics. I just want to bring out one more point, which is we've been discussing over the last few weeks the four parshiyos we read on the Shabbos around this time of year. We discussed Shkalim, we discussed Zachor, we discussed Para. And this coming week is the final of the four parshios, Parshas HaChodesh, which is where we read about the first time where God taught us about the calendar, where God says that Nisan should be the first of the months, which is in Parshas Va'era, I believe is where it is, Parshas Bo. And we read, because Nisan is coming up next week, so we read the part of the Torah which describes Nisan as the very first month of the year. That's the reading of Parshas HaChodesh. And in terms of symbolically what it means to us, I mean, Nisan is that first month, the month of Pesach, and the idea of a Chodesh, of a month in Jewish terms, the word Chodesh, the same word as Chadash, means new. And a Rosh Chodesh, when you start a new month, it's a time of renewal for a person. Just like the moon, we have lunar months, the moon wanes and waxes. So too, in terms of our own life situations, Rosh Chodesh is a time where of a time of renewal. It's Chodesh, it's Chadash, there's Yischachus, it's a time that we can refresh and recharge and renew ourselves. And the Jewish people are compared to the moon throughout the literature and the Torah and in the Gemara, etc. And the idea of the moon, if you view the sun is that most powerful force we have, life-giving force in our lives. It gives us warmth and heat and growth. And you know, God is compared to the sun. And we're compared to the moon. The moon is a reflection. The moon is a reflection of the sun's light, and the Jewish people should be a reflection of God's light. That's how we're supposed to be. So when you look at the moon, you understand it's not giving off its own light; it's giving off the light of the sun. You look at the Jewish people, you should see that they're people who give off a light, but it's a godly light. It's coming from somewhere else because they're loyal to God and they follow God's laws. They give off a special light as well. That's the ideal perspective on the Jewish people. So we talk about Rosh Chodesh itself, especially now. Parshas HaChodesh is where we really stress the idea of months. We point out that Nisan is the first month. It's the month where the Jews were saved from Egypt, and it's the time where we should reflect upon the idea that our lives wane and wax. So we have our ups and our downs, but there's always opportunity for renewal. And Pesach is that time where we renew ourselves, renew our relationship with God. It's time of freedom. And Rosh Chodesh monthly is a time where we can renew ourselves and feel that sense of freedom. And it's an important understanding that our lives do have ups and downs, just like the moon. It's there, it's not there, it's full, it's not full. Our lives are like that, but ultimately our lives should be that full moon reflecting back God's light. That's our perspective symbolically on Rosh Chodesh and the moon. It's interesting, it was the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people as a whole, was Rosh Chodesh. I mean, if you read through the Torah, in the book of Bereishis, there's three mitzvahs that are cited in the book of Bereishis, but those were given to individuals at the time. Adam and Eve were commanded to be fruitful and multiply. Avraham was commanded to have circumcision, bris milah, and then Yaakov was commanded not to eat of the gid hanasha, a certain sinew in the leg of an animal. But those were given to the individuals at that point. The first mitzvah given to the entire community, the Jewish people, was Rosh Chodesh. And that's symbolic of the fact that the reason that we're here in this world is because we do have the opportunity of always recharging and refreshing ourselves. And when we fall into a rut, we can always renew. And there's a message that life is not a static thing. Things do change. But yet, there has to be always an energy and excitement and a renewal in our lives. So every single month we have the opportunity. It might be more pronounced in Nisan, the time of Pesach, which is when nature refreshes itself, which is the springtime, when the trees start sprouting, you know, the birds start coming out, it's sunny, it's warmer, so it's in the, we hope it's supposed to snow tomorrow, I think, again. But it's supposed to be sunny and warmer. You know, but it's a time where it's, in the seasons, it's a time of renewal. Pesach's time of renewal, and Rosh Chodesh itself, throughout the year, should always be a time of renewal. So as we reflect upon the fourth of the four parshios, and that should be what we take away, is that we have to understand that our lives are about an energy and recharge and renewal, and we're never stuck in that pattern. We should always make sure our lives are being updated. My wife has told me, my wife was at a class a few weeks ago, she told me that the teacher gave an analogy, that just like the technology, we're always updating, you know, everyone gets the newest cell phone, the newest iPod, iPad, whatever it is. So people understand the concept of updating. If you're using the same cell phone that you used 12 years ago, it'd be this big clunky thing, wouldn't fit in your pockets. You know, we don't do that anymore. Now we have these nice sleek things in our pockets. We update ourselves. So in spirituality also, there's the idea of updating yourself. You know, we shouldn't be stuck in our same ways we're always stuck in. We should update our lives. You know, become better people. You know, find a new mitzvah we're going to do. Improve ourselves in certain in relationships. There's so many ways we can update our lives in spirituality as well. But the same way we update our lives technologically, we should also update our lives in the spiritual sense. So that's the lesson of Rosh Chodesh and Parshas Chodesh overall, is that life is full of renewal, opportunities for recharge and renewal and re-energizing. And that's really what's in the air this time of year, both in the Jewish yearly cycle, in nature, and hopefully in all our lives we could renew, refresh.
So what are the... I thought the four parshas were led up to Pesach, but we still have two more Shabbases after this one. So what parshas... Do they tie into Pesach at all?
No, this is the fourth of the four. The first one tied more into the month of Adar.
Oh.
Second one ties into Purim. The third and fourth tie in with Pesach. That was last week and this week. Once Nisan hits, there's no more of these four parshios. They're all done at this point.
But we still have two
weeks of Pesach.
2 weeks.
Right.
So nothing, no other transitions.
I mean, the transition is, the month of Nisan itself is a transition, that it's a joyous month.
I see, the month itself.
The month itself is looked at as a very joyous month overall.
I see.
That's a transition. But this is all preparation for the month.
For the transition.
Yeah, for the
month.
Transition.
That's what
yeah.
You're saying. Now I got it.
Right.
A little late here, I got it. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.